From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Donald Trump is under pressure not to walk away from the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement, including coming from British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson.
We think that it's a valuable agreement. We think it's one of the great achievements of collective diplomacy over the last couple of decades. We accept that Iranian behavior has been disruptive in the region. We accept that the president has some valid points that need to be addressed, but we believe they are capable of being addressed, and we hope the deal will be preserved.
One of the deal's chief proponents, French President Emmanuel Macron, is on a state visit to the U.S. German Chancellor Angela Merkel will meet Mr. Trump Friday at the White House, expected to urge him to back the deal. The president has called the three-year agreement flawed. It has a decision to make by May 12 whether to reimpose sanctions on Iran. Among his objections, Tehran's ballistic missile program, international inspections, and the so-called sunset clause. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif told the Foreign Policy Expert Group Council on Foreign Relations in New York, what needed is now is dialogue.
That is why we have suggested in a number of op-eds that I've written, as well as in other presentations, a regional dialogue forum.
In a Monday tweet, Mr. Zarif warned it's all or nothing regarding the deal. Former Malawian President Joyce Banda is expected to return Saturday after 3 years of self-imposed exile over corruption allegations. The scandal surrounding her administration came to be known as Cashgate, in which senior government officials siphoned millions from state coffers. It prompted a cutoff of foreign aid. Ms. Banda lost re-election in 2014 to incumbent Peter Mutharika. She's denied wrongdoing. This is VOA News. In Toronto, a driver behind the wheel of a white Ryder rental truck plowed into pedestrians on a crowded street Monday, killing 10, injuring 15. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation identified the driver as Alec Minassian, who reportedly has no militant connections, but a city police chief said it appears to have been a deliberate attack. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has visited the Chinese embassy in Pyongyang, expressing sympathy over Sunday's bus accident that killed more than 30 Chinese tourists. At the Pentagon, U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis expressed optimism about the prospect of U.S.-North Korean talks on denuclearization.
Right now, I think there's a lot of reasons for optimism that the negotiations will be fruitful. And we'll see.
But the White House said Pyongyang won't get sanctions relief until a concrete action is taken to give up its nuclear weapons. Saturday, the North pledged to forego further missile and nuclear testing and to close a testing facility. The Syrian army continued bombarding an Islamic State enclave south of Damascus Monday. The assault followed recapture of the rebel-held eastern Ghouta region earlier this month. Hundreds of IS fighters are believed to be holed up in Hajar al-Aswad and Yarmouk. Houthi rebels in Yemen Monday acknowledged their political leader was killed last week in a Saudi-led coalition airstrike on the port city of Hodeidah. Houthi leader Abdel Malik al-Houthi said it's with great sadness that Salah al-Samad was martyred Thursday, April 19. He vowed revenge. The UN, meantime, condemned an airstrike on a wedding party in Yemen Sunday that killed at least 20 people. The U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee narrowly recommended late Monday advancing the nomination of Central Intelligence Agency Director Mike Pompeo to the full Senate for confirmation as Secretary of State. The vote was strictly along party lines, 11 to 10. Pompeo's confirmation expected later this week to replace Rex Tillerson. It's a boy for the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge. Kate, the wife of Britain's Prince William, gave birth Monday to their third child, a boy weighing 3.8 kilograms. Hundreds, including John Loughery, gathered outside the hospital.
Episode Place. The Duchess of Cambridge came out in red, a beautiful for St. George's Day. Her baby boy is the first royal baby in history to be born on St. George's Day. The Duchess of Cambridge will never forget this, and I hope they call it George in the middle name.
The new addition to the British royal family is fifth in line to the throne. The UN cultural agency, the United Arab Emirates, and Iraq have jointly signed an agreement to finance the reconstruction of a landmark mosque in Mosul, blown up by Islamic State last year. The Grand Nuri Mosque dates to the 12th century and is famous for its leaning minaret. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
We'll be right back. Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Southern African leaders are meeting today in Angola's capital, Luanda, with elections in the DRC topping the agenda.
According to the Angolan Foreign Affairs Minister, Mr. Manuel Augusto, President Kabila himself is expected to participate in this summit.
That's veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaivai in the Angolan capital. The East African community says it wants to play a role in finding lasting peace in South Sudan. Meanwhile, a former South Sudan minister is blaming the leadership in Juba for political instability in the country. And the nurses' strike for better working conditions in Zimbabwe has ended.
The strike ended on the 22nd of April, and I'm pleased to say that services to our institutions is largely returned to normal.
David Parirenyatwa is the Zimbabwe Health Minister. There were more protests yesterday in Madagascar against new electoral reforms. And the former chair of Liberia's Truth and Reconciliation Commission welcomes a State Department Human Rights report on Liberia. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Leaders of the Southern African Development Community, SADC, are meeting today in the Angolan capital, Luanda, with a focus on consolidating democracy in the sub-region, particularly in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Lesotho, Madagascar, and Zimbabwe. The main opposition coalition in the DRC says it wants the SADC leaders to tell President Joseph Kabila not to seek another term. A DRC government official told VOA yesterday that Mr. Kabila may not attend today's meeting, but veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaivai says Angolan Foreign Minister Manuel Augusto says Mr. Kabila will attend.
In fact, some heads of state already arrived in Luanda, the Angolan capital, and the other ones must arriving early morning. In fact, this head of state summit was preceded by the meetings of the ministers of foreign affairs on Monday. And the discussions were focused on the situation on the Democratic Republic of Congo in a way to find out a solution and a commitment to the incoming elections, which are supposed to be held in 23 of December 2018. According to the Angolan Foreign Affairs Minister, Mr. Manuel Augusto, President Kabila himself is expected to participate in this summit, which, according to words of Mr. Manuel Augusto, could be seen as a guarantee to find a real solutions for the current turmoil in Democratic Republic of Congo and find out a consensus between Kabila's government and the opposition parties and the civil society to be committed to the election calendar this year.
Mario, just on Monday, I was speaking to someone in the DRC government who said that Kabila may not attend. So did you say that the foreign minister said that President Kabila will attend?
Yes, it's true. So he said that the other heads of state are expecting that Mr. Kabila will attend the summit. Because, as you know, the DRC, as a part of conflict, he is not a member of the so-called double SADC Troika, which will be meeting this Tuesday. But I must also say that a part of the DRC team, they will be discussing the situation at Lesotho, and there is a proposal on the table that the missions of the SADC peacekeeping forces in Lesotho will be extended at least 6 months or 12 months. And the summit will underline that the Lesotho authorities also to be committed with the SADC roadmap to sort out the crisis in this small kingdom, Lesotho.
Now, the Angolan foreign minister was quoted as saying that the focus will be to consolidate democracy in the Southern African region. We know that there are problems in Madagascar. We know DRC. And recently, Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, the founding president, was removed by the military. It will be interesting to see whether SADC will make a comment on the removal of President Robert Mugabe.
Yes, the Angolan foreign minister also said that there is a need in the Southern African regions that all governments must be committed with the agenda of democracy, fair and free elections, and the respect of human rights.
That was veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaivai speaking with me from the capital, Luanda. The East African community says it wants to play a role in South Sudan's ongoing peace negotiations. This comes after South Sudanese lawmakers accused the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGA, of stalling the talks. Moses Xavier Rimana reports from the Tanzanian capital, Dodoma.
The East African community has officially applied to the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, to allow the East African Legislative Assembly members to participate in the South Sudan peace talks. South Sudan authorities have complained that IGAD mediation seems not to be making progress after more than 4 years of negotiations. Thomas Gatkek is a South Sudanese lawmaker.
Why we have initiated an involvement of the community is because we have a doubt. We are doubting the initiative being held by the IGAD, because if you could see, the peace talk have taken years. The initiative itself is not bringing peace, being the government and the rebel happen to pray in one place. Whenever the two sides are about to progress in the peace talk, IGAD comes up with other proposals which are not even relevant to solve the conflict.
In February this year, the second round of the South Sudan peace talks took place in Addis Ababa but were stalled after the government objected to a clause calling for punitive measures against saboteurs for the peace talks. Previous agreements have also been violated within hours of signing. Peter Munya is Kenya's East African Community Minister.
Part of the reasons actually to admit South Sudan was to make community a stabilizing factor. There's a lot of frustration because the steps that have been taken so far have not brought the desired results. So even the member states themselves are frustrated with the slowness and the stubbornness of some of the players in the South Sudanese peace process.
The African Union Peace and Security Council delegation met in Juba this month with South Sudanese officials ahead of the next round of peace talks that was initially scheduled for this Thursday, but were postponed until further notice. Kasamba Matias is a Ugandan lawmaker.
Wars will not solve the problems of South Sudan. It is talking to each other. It is sitting together, talking to each other, agreeing that we may be diverse in our ways of agreement, but the ultimate end is realizing that we are all Sudanese. We must work together for the stability of South Sudan. And I think this is one of the reasons why the summit admitted South Sudan.
According to the East African community, more than 1 million South Sudanese refugees are hosted by Uganda, the largest refugee for a single country. A political dispute between Salva Kiir and his former deputy Riek Machar sparked a war in December 2013. According to the United Nations, at least 50,000 people were killed in the conflict that ensued. Moses Xavier Imana, VOA Africa, Dodoma, Tanzania.
South Sudan's former Minister of Education says South Sudanese leaders are responsible for the political instability in the country. Peter Adwak Nyamba says the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement is to blame for the crisis in South Sudan. Adwak says the people of South Sudan have not enjoyed their independence because of power struggle within the ruling party.
So if there's anything, either by commission or by omission, it all comes back to the FCLM, whether in 2013 or you express it back to the Liberation Day, because this is what the situation is. It has evolved over the time as a result of some of the developments within the FCLM.
Most of the people that I've spoken to who normally come out of Juba would turn around and point fingers at President Kiir. Most of them would say President Kiir has failed to lead the country out of the crisis.
President Salva Kiir is the product of the FCLM. He didn't come there by himself. So you trace it back to the FCLM. That's what I was meaning.
What legacy is left for the SPLM? Is there any legacy?
This is what it is, and you look at it from different sides. That even when they are talking about reunification now, what does it really mean? To me, I've reached a conclusion that really SPLM it's about time to bury it and we forget about it, you know, because it has not done anything better for the people of South Sudan. On the contrary, a lot of negativity we see today are things which we trace to the SPLA. People will tell you that, okay, SPLA brought independence, it brought this. Yes, it is the people, it is the struggle of the people of South Sudan that has really brought the independence. It's the voting that in the referendum that brought the independence in 2011.
From what I'm hearing from you, there is nothing that SPLM should be proud of in South Sudan.
Even people laugh at it, you know, when they say now, when they are united, the SPLM leaders steal the money, and when they fragment, they kill the people. It's a sad history, anyway.
Let's look at the dynamics in the country. Of recent, the opposition came together and called themselves South Sudan Opposition Alliance. And your group, yes, the SPLM-IO, opted not to join the boat. Is there any specific reason why the SPLM-IO is sitting on the fence when everybody is now coming together?
Let's count them all. Is there anybody who has not been part of this SPLM, Johnson, who is not really a member of the SPLM? But all the rest, the opposition, were members of the SPLM at one time, starting with Dr. Lam. Dr. Lam was a member of the SPLM, membership of the leadership of the SPLM. Okay? Now, when you come to a person like Johnson, Gabriel Johnson, he was also a member of the IO from 2014 until he broke away from it in 2015. So, actually, everybody in one way or the other has been a member of the SPLM-SPLA.
That was Peter Awak Nyamba, South Sudan's former Minister of Education, member of the SPLM-IO. He was speaking with John Tanza of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and today is Tuesday, April 24th. Daybreak Africa time is 17 and a half minutes past the hour. Supporters of two former Madagascar presidents, Marc Ravalomanana and Andry Rajoelina, protested Monday against new electoral laws in the capital, Antananarivo. This followed a similar protest over the weekend, which left one person dead and many injured. The protesters say the new electoral laws will prevent both Ravalomanana and Rajoelina from contesting the upcoming elections. Madagascar goes to the polls on November 24th and December 24, 2018. This to elect the president and National Assembly. For the latest development, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Sahondra Rabananarivo, a lawyer and a leading member of FAFI, a civil society group based in the Madagascar capital.
The initial reactions coming from the government, especially the president himself, who made a five-minute televised statement, do not sound very conciliatory. So I would hope that they would listen. They haven't been listening for several weeks now, several months, as we have most of the people, civil society, other political parties have already called for certain amendments to the election laws. And unfortunately, we have come to this situation because they would not consider those comments or requests.
So you don't see the government reversing its decision with respect to this electoral laws that people find quite divisive?
Well, I hope so, but the signs do not yet indicate that they are willing to do so. They have had multiple opportunities to do so previously to these demonstrations. Perhaps now they will. But the early signs coming from the government are not particularly reassuring in terms of their willingness to reconsider some of the provisions of the electoral laws. And it's because of the underlying changes that are being requested that may weaken their position in the election or allow certain candidates to participate that they are unwilling to do. They want to exclude some opposing candidates.
Now, the issue of Marc Ravalomanana comes into play. Some of his supporters are saying the electoral laws literally seek to exclude him from running for president. Do you think their concerns are legitimate?
Yes, I do. Even though the law that was voted in Parliament and has been sent to the High Constitutional Court for approval have not been published. Most of us do not know the exact contents. But the draft laws, before they were submitted to Parliament, did include provisions that would have automatically excluded Marc Ravalomanen, and arguably might have excluded also André Zouille.
Now, talking about these two political opponents who appear to have joined forces, talking about former President Marc Ravalomanen, who was literally kicked out by André Rajoelina, they are coming together against this law. Some people are saying it seems this is a political strange bedfellows uniting against a cause. Your take?
Yes, well, there's a very short-term interest, which is that they both fear being excluded and not being able to run at all. So they share that interest in a very short-term way. There might be some calculations if they look at the demographics and how the vote might split. They might both consider it as a way to get to the second round and exclude the sitting president. But beyond that, they do not have any alliance to speak of or any personal affection between them.
Sahondra Rabina-Rivo is a lawyer and a leading member of FAFI, a civil society group in Madagascar. She spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Antananarivo. Thousands of Zimbabwean nurses returned to work on Monday after ending a major strike for better working conditions and improved pay. But it was not immediately clear whether their demands had been met. A spokesman for the Nurses Association says renewed negotiations with the government were expected to begin. The government fired the nurses during the strike, accusing them of being politically motivated. Here is Zimbabwe Health Minister David Parirenyatwa announcing the end of the strike.
The strike ended on the 22nd of April. But also just to remind you that the number of nurses that are in the public health sector is 16,974. So essentially it means a third of the nurses were on industrial action. And I'm pleased to say that services to our institutions has largely returned to normal. And we've utilized nurses who did not participate in the industrial action. They have been beefed up by the recruitment of qualified nurses who were not employed, our unemployed nurses. But also what we did was to make sure that during that time, all official leave was cancelled and they were recalled to duty to beef up everybody. And I must add that the majority of nurses who were dismissed have since reapplied for re-engagement, and government has permitted them to resume duty pending final approval from the employer. And you know the employer is the Health Services Board. So as we carry out these recruitment processes, the ministry has allocated specific quotas per institution of new registered general nurses. It is very, very regrettable and very unfortunate that the nurse fraternity chose to down tools when government was seriously addressing the issues that nurses and other health professional categories had raised in terms of allowances and relativities. It's important to know that that was the part of the major complaint, outside the issues that we all know that we really need to improve the infrastructure in our hospitals, which we are all alert to, and the government is very seized with that. But the issue here was allowances and also relativities. Some people were earning much more than should have earned, or much less than what they should have earned. And government is urgently looking into the outstanding cross-cutting issues and with a view to resolve them as soon as possible. But I think we want to thank those nurses and other health professionals who continued to provide their services over this very, very difficult period.
David Parirenyatwa is Zimbabwe's health minister. He spoke Monday in Harare during a news conference. The former chair of Liberia's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the TRC, is welcoming a U.S. State Department human rights report which points to arbitrary killings by the Liberian National Police and government corruption during former President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's government. Former TRC Chairman Jerome Verdier says the report's findings are a wake-up call to President George Weah to address past human rights abuses and corruption in Liberia.
Certainly, the Sirleaf government didn't do much to address issues of impunity and justice, and those issues are captured in that report. Despite the training the police and security forces, the abuses were widespread. Indeed, it is more than a wake-up call for the new government. It is a note of caution to the new government to address these past issues. For indeed, impunity is an everyday thing in Liberia, and we hope that the new government can position itself to begin to address the issues of impunity and corruption and pay attention to the TRC report if it wants to do well on those two counts.
This report is addressing particularly what it called the Liberian National Police and other security forces violating the penal code of excessive force to abuse, harass, and intimidate persons in police custody.
Yes, that's true. It has been happening for quite a while, especially during the second term of President Sirleaf. The police and security forces behave in very indisciplined manner. They use excessive force against ordinary citizens. There were cases of theft and robbery. Here, most of those guys who were decommissioned or disrobed have been brought back into service under the new government. So indiscipline is widespread, and the government of the past didn't seem to have the will, political and otherwise, to address these concerns that the Human Rights Report of the U.S. State Department raised. We can hope that that bureau can begin to address these human rights concerns. Otherwise, there may be a breakdown of the rule of law, a breakdown of law and order, and we could be heading back to crisis, which we're hoping never to return to.
On the issue of human rights, it seems that Liberians' concern about the violation of human rights and maybe war crimes have been very busy lately. Just last week, there was the Django Jabba in Philadelphia who has been sentenced to 30 years. And then now a case against the former defense minister of Charles Taylor's rebel movement, Tom Wowoyou, is coming up later this year. What do you make of, first of all, these developments?
Well, we are glad that these developments are happening, and we have commented that the wheels of justice may be slowly turning, but it doesn't stop. You know, the international community is determined to address justice issues around the world, and Django Jabba got what he rightly deserves, Charles Taylor's son. And we are certain that the crisis will unfold very soon in due time on others, collaborators, others, allies, and those who aided and abetted are in the commission of those crimes in Liberia. We will want the government of Liberia to partner with the international community in ensuring that the issues of impunity and justice are addressed in Liberia.
Jerome Verdier is the former chair of Liberia's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. He was speaking with me from South Africa. And that's it for this Tuesday, April 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Dave Magnus, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.